Welcome back to On the Page, where we talk to people who inspire us, hopefully you, on writing, on publishing. We're the Writers Festival of Belgium. We have one of our first interviews this year is with Alexandra Huddleston, who is based out in New Mexico in the United States of America, who was lovely enough to take the time to tell us a bit about her publishing journey. She's a photographer who it ended up being that she turned some works into what she felt was the most appropriate form of a printed book. And now she's publishing the book of a local Brussels artist who is Mimi Koons. It's a mixture of poetry and visuals that are painted about the mother and baby, mother and child relationship, which are really beautiful. In any case, so Alexandra published her book, Mother Tongue, which is a lovely publication. And we talked to her a little bit about that as well, but also about what the journey and of becoming a printing house or a publishing house by herself, what that's been like so far. So stay tuned and thanks for joining us.
So you're a photographer slash publisher, correct?
And that's more? Correct.
Or is that?
Well, I list my jobs, yeah. As you know, all of us nowadays in the creative fields are doing like three or four things at the same time, right? You know, up until I did my master's in fine art, really my education was very academically focused. But I realized early on, even in high school, that if I wasn't taking art classes, I became very unhappy. And I really had to always prioritize that. And it was something I have to consciously prioritize because the people around me, it's not that they discouraged me in the arts, but people aren't going to encourage you to take art classes.
Yeah.
So I had to prioritize it myself, which I did. And that's also the time when I realized how interested I was in photography. Mm. Because before then, in terms of my arts, what I took seriously was the painting, the drawing, the printmaking. Ironically, I always took photographs. I have albums and albums of photographs I've taken since I was six in all the countries we've lived in. So this making photographs and making books was this kind of instinctive thing. I got my first camera when I was six, right before we went to Mali. I started making my first photo album soon after that. But I didn't take it seriously as an art form because I just wasn't exposed to photography as a serious art until I went to college. Even after university, I moved to New York. I was already at that time realizing that art had to be a priority in my career. My early jobs in New York, I worked as a gallery assistant for a while, and then I worked at the New Museum of Contemporary Art, actually, as an administrative assistant for a while, all the while doing my own work on the side. By that time, mainly photography, and then after work ended, you know, after I clocked out, I'd run up to the International Center of Photography, which had facilities for people to print in black and white, which is what I was doing, shooting film, printing black and white. And so, I mean, in your 20s, you have the energy for that. You work 8 hours a day at your day job, and then you run uptown, and you work in the darkroom for 3 or 4 hours in the night. Then you go home and sleep, and you repeat it. And that's like what I did for three or four years when I was living in New York. So by the time I had left college, I was already very serious, you know, about, I didn't know exactly what form it would take, right? But about pursuing a career in the arts. The photography is the core. That's sort of that's what started me going. And then I suppose the next step was becoming a publisher. First, it was a self-publisher because I had books I wanted to get out. And I looked, like many people, I looked into working with other publishers and in the end decided self-publishing was the best way to go. And then along with that, I guess the next step was being a walking artist, which is sort of the third job title, or it's connected with the photography. So as I got into landscape work, I got into the landscape work through walking. mm-hmm. in particular through walking these long pilgrimages, right, that so many people have done now. In the course of the pilgrimages, I saw that how I was looking and depicting the land totally changed because of the walking, right, mm-hmm. for weeks at a time. And so since then, over time, I became more and more interested in the question of mm-hmm. how our way of movement influences how we see and depict landscapes. And that became a core of my photography work. And then the last sort of hat would be a rider. And that's mm-hmm. something I've slowly developing more now, to be writing about my experiences in landscape.
So tell me about the pilgrimages. Which ones? What? Or are they personal ones? Or are they ones like the Caminos de Santiago, like ones that are...
Well, a bit of both, right? I think I started in 2009, like so many people, on the Camino. Wow, and the main, okay. you know, the Camino Frances of the Camino de Santiago, which is the main route that most people do. And my early work was, a lot of it was documentary focus, documentary photography. Mm-hmm. And I started the Camino with the mindset of a documentary photographer. I was like, you know, here we are in the 21st century and 250,000 of people a year are walking the Camino de Santiago at the same time as church attendance is declining, right? Mm-hmm. These are facts. Mm-hmm. What's going on? What is this about? And so I went and walked it with my camera as a kind of ethnographer, you know, personal immersion, ethnography, documentary photography experience.
Starting somewhere in the south of France or in
Yeah, Spain? So like many people, starting at Saint-Jean-Pied-de-Port, the okay. first day, across the Pyrenees, right. and then enter Spain, and then the rest of it, walk to Santiago de Compostela, and then end at Finisterre. That takes about a month.
So you did the whole thing?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
What
yeah.
did you think?
Well, in the course of it, so of course what happened at the beginning, I was taking pictures of people, you know, of my own experience, my blisters, mm-hmm. the people around me, everyone doing their laundry in the evening, you know, like the whole pilgrim experience from this documentary perspective. But as the pilgrimage progressed, I became less and less interested in the people and more interested in the landscape. It really taught me how to see landscape, that walk, in a way I hadn't really been able to before, honestly. Mm-hmm. I'd hiked before with my family. We were a hiking family. But, yeah, never really, really focused on the land around me in that way, in that intense way. That happens when you're walking because you're there day after day. You're getting rained on, mud on your boots. And in the evening, you have to wash the mud off your boots, you know, otherwise you won't be able to use them. The heat affects your body in such a physical way, or, you know, or the cold, whatever it is, that you are forced to grapple, you know, with the space around you, the real landscape around you, the bugs, the weather, the light. In a way, I think when we live in an urban environment or we live such a car-based lifestyle, we can often ignore and forget. Mm. So I realized in the process of that pilgrimage, my whole understanding of land and what I wanted to photograph and how I wanted to show it changed. The other aspect of it, which I noticed in the course of the pilgrimage and became also key to my understanding of landscape, was realizing that I was walking through a historical and a created religious landscape, mm-hmm. right? When you're on the pilgrimage, it's the pilgrim trail itself, which has been created both over the centuries by pilgrim feet and tradition and habit, and in recent years by UNESCO, mm-hmm. you know, and other local and nationwide organizations, you know, that maintain it and create laws around it. But along with that path, which is in itself this ancient infrastructure, you have everything around that. You have fountains, which can be centuries old, mm-hmm. Of course, chapels, cathedrals, entire towns, right, in Spain that exist because of that pilgrim path.
Yeah.
As well as all the smaller things, the little crosses people leave beside the trail, the stones they place on the markers, the vending machines they put up with pilgrim paraphernalia for you to buy. All of these are landscape. All of these are infrastructure, landscape infrastructure that is connected to human culture, in this case, religion and spirituality. I did two other pilgrimages and I kept reading and I kept photographing and just to see where it led me. So the second one was actually in Japan, the Shikoku pilgrimage around the island of Shikoku, which is a circular pilgrimage. I think it's about 1,400 kilometers, 800 miles. So that's a longer one, much, much more intense and a lot less walkers. And then the third one to kind of conclude the pilgrimage trilogy was a French section of the Camino de Santiago from Le Puy-en-Velay back to Saint-Jean-Pied-de-Port, where I started. And then after those three pilgrimages, especially on the last one, I started meeting people who'd done the Camino five times or six times. And I'm like, okay, I can totally see how this can become an addiction. In fact, I'm well on that path after three myself. So maybe I should put this aside for the time being and do other types of walks. So after that, I wouldn't call my other walks pilgrimages, but I've continued to do long walks, exploring landscapes in a sort of a more looser, more secular way. So I've done, like I've walked from Maastricht to Cologne. I've walked the West Highland Way in Scotland.
Oh, beautiful.
I've walked the Hadrian's Wall. And then I've explored areas, you know, in a less linear fashion, right? As I've explored them as a walking artist, as a walker, to see how walking a particular landscape will change my photography and even reveal aspects of the land to me that otherwise wouldn't be evident.
Do you think that you remember the first time you heard about the concept of a pilgrim, like going somewhere with a goal? And did you have one, or was it something else that pushed you to get out there? Like you needed space, or you needed to walk? Or
you needed I absolutely remember. I think, and I think many pilgrims do, that I think many people who become pilgrims at some point earlier in their life hear about the pilgrimage. And it's like a little hook. That's how I describe it, that they're like a fish. We're like a fish that gets caught on a hook. Yeah. And that fishing line might be very, very long. It might take 10 or 20 years before it reels us in. But once that little hook's in your brain, it's not going to let you go. You eventually will go and walk a pilgrimage. And for me, actually, the hook hit my brain. I was studying Spanish in Spain one summer. And after the course, you know, the study abroad course, I was interested in going to Santiago de Compostela. As a nearby city, I learned about the pilgrimage there. And then in the course of, you know, traveling around Europe, I decided to also, on that same trip, I went up to Roncesvalles. It was before the pilgrimage had become popular. So the monastery at Roncesvalles was operating as a youth hostel, and it was completely empty. And there was nothing to do. I was like, why am I here? Why did I come out here? There was nothing to do but walk the hills. So that's what I did. And I met like one pilgrim that day. It was only one pilgrim. I mean, nowadays, if you go up to Roncesvalles, even in the winter, you'll probably meet half a dozen or more. And in the summer, you'll meet hundreds. And you're not even allowed to stay in the monastery anymore because there's too many pilgrims. And there's a huge warehouse where they put you with like hundreds of bunk beds all together, which was quite a shock for me, right? When I went back as a real pilgrim. And I met this pilgrim, like, oh yes, I'm off to Santiago. And I somehow, you know, I was in just being in the mountains and looking at that path and realizing that it continued all across Spain, which I just a journey I'd just taken myself by train from Santiago to Pamplona up to Roncesvalles. But this path continued all the way to Santiago. And if I wanted, I could walk it. Mm-hmm. And I had a big backpack, like lots of young people traveling with Europe, which was too heavy, certainly to walk 15 miles or 20 miles a day with. Mm-hmm. And I was supposed to go to college in a month. So at that time, I was like, well, I guess I shouldn't. I shouldn't just ditch half of my clothes and go walk to Santiago tomorrow, although it's really tempting.
Mm.
But someday I will come back and I will walk this path. You know, time rolled on, you get involved in other things. I had some frequent flyer miles and I had the time and the idea returned. And so I decided to go. And I was actually quite surprised then in 2009 when I did walk the pilgrimage to see all these people, hundreds of people around me on the trail, that in those, you know, intervening years since that it had suddenly everyone else was wanting to walk it too.
You know, you said that you were talking to people, you were looking at people taking photos of people and seeing that. And then all of a sudden it shifted to the landscape. What do you think it was about the landscape that made it like come into focus? So was it the mountains, like you were saying, or was it something else in particular? Or was it just that you were living the landscape every day? So it started shifting kind of around you and giving you something to look at that you hadn't thought of before, or hadn't seen before.
Yeah, I really do think it's the latter. You know, this whole concept of embodied knowledge, I think is something that nowadays people are talking about more in the arts.
Okay.
Certainly they weren't talking about it all that much, you know, in 2009, when I did the pilgrimage and started to get into it. At that time, you had a few authors writing about the pilgrimage, which was why it was becoming popular. But after the pilgrimage, I was trying to figure out what happened to me. What happened? Why did this big transformation happen? Was it the walking? I didn't think it was the religion because I'm not really Catholic, although I've always been interested in spirituality. I didn't think the religion was irrelevant because if you're on a pilgrimage, you do think perhaps a bit more about your daily actions and the consequences of them. And the symbolism of it, right? Then I think if you're just hiking. I knew something profound had changed. And part of the reason that I did the other pilgrimages, especially the one in Japan, was to figure that out. You know, with the Japanese pilgrimage, we're changing the religion. We're changing the culture. You're changing the landscape. So I was really curious, would this same sort of physical, mental, perceptual transformation also happened on the pilgrimage in Japan. And it did. So it was clearly the walking. And the walking, I think, for such a long time. Now, I mean, if you walk for a week continuously, you're going to have a change in you. But a month is a very particular amount of time. And I think there are certain stages of transformation, physical and psychological, that happen in the course of that month. And having done it three times, you know, I with myself as an experimental subject, basically, I can say that there are these stages that change you. And I've read other people's books and I've talked to other pilgrims, and it's something that's real. I realize it wasn't just me, or it wasn't just Spain, it wasn't just that time in my life. It is something very specific that happens in the human body and in the human psyche when you walk continuously for 3 to 4 weeks. So, you know, I don't know that everybody's becomes more interested in landscape per se, as I did, but I don't think that's an unusual change. And it's, as you say, it's because you are living the land space around you in such an embodied way, right? If you get blisters, you're really noticing what is underfoot.
Yeah.
Are you walking on asphalt? How hot is it? Are you walking on grass? Are you walking on stones? You know, every stone that hits your blister, you're going to notice. So it can be something really tangible, just like the material of the path that you walk on. And the pilgrim path is made of all those materials in the course of its length. Things like where is the next water? Is there a fountain in this town? Where do I get water? How heavy is water? How do I carry it? What does the water mean in this landscape, in this environment? all of those things become, they become key to even your, I mean, not key to your survival per se, right? Because we're in Spain and you have your cell phone and the next town really isn't that far away. Yeah. Even if at the end of the day, 3 kilometers might seem like, you know, really far away. It's not. You feel it that way. You feel that how key the land is, what the land contains, where water is, how much the sun is, how all of those things impact your very health. That's the other thing you realize. Like some pilgrims, everyone does the pilgrimage differently, right? And some people are there for religion, although probably they're in the minority. Some people are there for a more specific sort of personal spiritual journey, whether it's connected with religion or not. A lot of people are just there out of curiosity. Yeah. Some people are there to lose weight. You know, some people are there as a cheap vacation. But, you know, one thing I'll say is, even if people go into it thinking that it's just to lose weight, something still changes. That's the other thing. You know, some people are like, well, if you don't want, according to the Catholic Church, right, to get your little credencial at the end, you only have to walk, I think it's something like the last 100 or 250 kilometers. You know, you have to have your stamps to prove that. That's all they require to have completed the Camino de Santiago, which also means like when you get within a week of Santiago de Compostela, the number of pilgrims increases because a lot of people just do enough to get their sheet of paper, their official credencial. But, you know, some people say, oh, you have to walk the whole thing. If you take a bus through the suburbs of Pamplona because they're ugly and it's hot, you know, you're cheating. I have a very loose view, right? Like, I actually did walk the whole thing and I carried my own luggage the whole way. And that was important to my experience. But for those who have a service take their luggage from place to place or who take a bus through the ugly suburbs of the various cities, like, that's their pilgrimage, right? Everyone has a different physical needs and tolerance for different things. And so I think it's good to be forgiving. And again, for some people, you know, some people are always cooking their meals. Like they eat hard-boiled eggs and sliced ham and cheese for every dinner and macaroni and cheese and this and that. You know, at some point, probably decided that I really want to eat the local specialties of the Spanish towns that I'm walking through. And so I did. And fortunately, I found a friend, an Irish pilgrim friend, who just like me was willing to spend, you know, 5 or 10 euros more an evening to eat at a good local place. And that became a joy and part of the experience.
So for those who haven't seen your artwork, what was that was one of the first times that you had already been doing, you had already been taking photographs and creating art before this, or that it was on the Camino that the landscape kind of took all your focus?
So I had been a serious photographer before. My early work, which isn't so... I don't profile it on my website now because it's very different from what I do now, right?
Okay.
My early work was in doing documentary photography.
Right.
So actually the project that I've done up to now that got the most attention, shall we say, was I got a Fulbright grant to live for a year in Timbuktu in 2006-2007.
Yeah.
And photograph and research the ancient Islamic scholarship in Timbuktu. You know, it was all connected with the ancient manuscripts in Timbuktu, which at that time were in the news quite a bit.
Yeah.
So I was interviewing and photographing the families who are preserving the manuscripts and the schools that still exist where people were learning from the manuscripts and learning in that ancient tradition. And I eventually, that's how I got into the self-publishing because after that was over, I had, you know, 10,000 photos and I knew it needed to be a book. If you're researching a scholarly tradition that is connected to manuscripts, you need to make a book, don't you?
Yeah, of course.
It just seems to be the logical thing to do. In the course of that year, I recorded at that time I was writing my interviews, but you know, I did many interviews and made over 10,000 photographs. And as I put them together, I realized that it was a work that should be a book. It was the book I made is in many, many university libraries because my documentation of what was happening at the time is pretty unique, especially since later in 2014, there was all this disruption with the invasion of Timbuktu by Islamist forces and the confusion and that continues, you know, within the Malian government that's happened since then. So it was kind of this unique moment. I was there and I did a very thorough documentation of the type of schools from elementary education to higher education that were happening. And so it's a book and a project that has had a lot of interest for institutions, right? That to have African studies components. Yeah, so soon after I came back, I knew I wanted it to be a book. And I was on my own in editing the work, putting together the text, and even figuring out how I wanted to publish it. And it was, as I said, it was that journey which led me to the self-publishing.
So you could see what you wanted it to be, and then how did it end up being? And what was that process like for the self-published? And now, like you were saying, like in hindsight, how...
Yeah, well, one thing I think many people with their first book realize is that it takes, especially the first book, takes a lot longer than you generally imagine. I listened to one of your previous podcasts and the author had taken half her life, right, to write her first book. And that didn't surprise me. I mean, now I feel like, oh, 5-6 years, okay, I'm doing well. But in 2008, I made the decision to come to Santa Fe. Previously, I'd been in New York, on my own, but I said, I have these 10,000 photos. I want to make a book.
Yeah.
So what's the choice? I either go to New York, I have to work full time just to pay the rent, and I do my little work to make my book on the side, or I come to Santa Fe where my parents have retired. I live with them and I can work mostly full time to put the book together. So I decided to go with the latter. There are pros and cons to that. If I had been in New York, I might have found more support to help me with the process, but that I found out here. But I went with the second choice and worked on the edit. But I thought, oh yeah, so I'll come out here for 1 or 2 years, you know, and make the book, publish it, and then go on. And of course, I'm still in New Mexico after over 10 years. The book was published, though, 2013, at last. But that was, as you see, you know, 2008, I returned from Africa, and that was 5 years later that it was actually published. So once I had a manuscript for it, a basic edit, and that book in particular, you know, in my archives, I have 4, 5, 6 versions of designs for that book that I basically made my mock-ups I made myself, and in the process showing it to anyone, basically anyone that would look at it, whether they were artists or photographers or people in the photo world, just getting their advice on both the design of the book and the edit of the photos, but also try to get their advice on what should I do about publishing. And I didn't find a lot of satisfaction in supporting the work here, you know, out here in New Mexico. And even New York, when I would talk to people about it, it was a sort of limited support. But when I was showing the mock-up and the project to people in Western Europe, I found a lot more support for it. I think there just is, and I found that to be true, to be honest, with my work as a whole. And in the case of the Timbuktu work, I think that in Western Europe, there's just more of a larger audience of people who are interested in stories and work about West Africa. I mean, it's a lot closer.
Sure. That's interesting, though, as well, because you would think it would be such a like a global kind of interest, but it sounds like it gets down to very specific.
No, on the whole, I just found, even when it came, during that process, when I was trying to find support for the work, whether to make an exhibition, but also to make the book, you know, I was reaching out to many publishers. If I looked back, I think I must have reached out to over 50 or more publishers of all different types. And so the academic publishers were quite interested in it, but even the academic publishers all required this subvention. And when it's an image-based book, which mine is, I think some of the more text-based books that some of your audience are used to, the subvention is very high. So even these university publishers wanted a subvention of $20,000 from me.
All right.
So I pay them that money for them to publish my book. And that's what I learned in the process, is that's very normal. I mean, there were a handful of academic publishers interested. There were art publishers interested, maybe more in, that's where, you know, more in Western Europe than in the US. Small art publishers, for example, in the Netherlands, one in Italy, who were interested in the work. But all of them wanted the money, this money. Right. And I was very hesitant. At that time, I was learning that everybody was asking for this, but I was very hesitant to pay that much money to a publisher for them to publish my book and for a work that I knew was a worthy topic. I must have at least half a dozen publishers were quite interested in it if I paid them.
So you published it, or someone did?
Yeah. So at one point, I was talking with someone who knew the photo industry well, and they looked at the work and they said, well, this is a great work. Why don't you just self-publish? And this was fairly early days in self-publishing, right? Because this is around 2011, 2012. They had self-published. They'd found satisfaction, you know, in the process. And that was also the time when it was normal to do crowdfunding. So, you know, now I think it's, crowdfunding can be more problematic because it's been around so long and there's been abuses and this, that, and the other. But at that time, it was a fairly new thing. It worked pretty well, you know. And so I decided to follow his advice and just self-publish, crowdfund to raise, you know, one way or another, I realized I needed to raise $20,000.
Yeah.
So why not raise the money and publish it myself?
Yeah.
And that's what I did. I mean, it all sounds easy in retrospect, but in the process, you know, on the fifth day of your crowdfunding campaign, and you realize the numbers are, it isn't a matter of just sending a mass email and having everyone give you the money you need, and that it's going to be
it's like a full
much more work than you expect.
Just a little tiny bit on the practicalities, because I love this stuff.
Yeah.
You found a local printer, or you knew someone mentioned, like how did it physically become, or you chose one of the publishers and gave them the money that was raised?
So I didn't choose a publisher.
Right.
And part of that was because I knew there was actually one particular issue, or two, but one very important, which was the issue of translation.
Right.
And I knew I wanted to make a bilingual book. That I knew the first edition, I wanted it to be bilingual, English and French. That was really important to me, because you never know if the book will actually get a translation. And I wanted to make a book that the people I had worked with in Timbuktu could read. You know, I couldn't make it translated into four languages, you know, which would have also included Songhai and Tamashek, you know, and maybe Arabic. That was too much for me. I'm self-publishing after all. It's like, okay, let's do English and French so that they can read what I am saying about them. You know, that was really, really key to me. And most publishers don't want to do that. They want to reserve translation for a second selling, you know, a way to make money through resale rights and other things. But having it be that book being bilingual was absolutely essential. And I also didn't really want it to be a coffee table book. And it is actually a very small and modest book, about half the size of Mimi's. But it's a subject with the type of photos that most people want to make into a coffee table book.
When you applied for that Fulbright, you had already like set out exactly what you wanted to do there. And did it change when you got there, or you had to do what you said you were going to do and then...
Well, I think with grants, they are pretty, most granting organizations understand that things change.
Okay.
But the strange thing actually is that I more or less did exactly what I set out to do.
Okay, well, that's great.
I was willing for it to change. I think it's important to be flexible.
Yeah.
You don't know exactly what you will find. But I said I wanted to photograph the scholars, and I thought, here's the cover, I photographed the scholars.
It was also their printing practice, or it was just them, or do they mostly write by hand?
They write by hand. All the manuscripts are handwritten.
And then, the printed version, you did that with you found like a...
Oh, right, so the printer. So the same photographer who said to me, you know, I think everyone who publishes, whether with a publisher or self-publishing, but maybe especially self-publishing, has these moments, certain conversations that really are key. And so this one conversation with this photographer, Chris Graves, who'd previously, you know, I said he had experience self-publishing, and he said, you should just self-publish. And he had worked with a printer in Iceland called Odi.
Okay.
And so he knew, as a photographer who'd self-published, that they were very happy to be working with self-publishers and very flexible and easy to communicate with. History, in a funny way, always, in retrospect, influences things. So if you think this is 2012, roughly, it's after the financial collapse in Iceland.
Yeah.
So the businesses in Iceland were looking for all sorts of ways to, you know, to increase their revenue. And in this case, OD as a publisher, one of the ways it was doing that was being very open and flexible, as a printer, I should say, in working with individuals who wanted to self-publish. Okay. And the cost was... cheaper than, say, working with a printer in Germany or Italy, right, which are traditionally the super fancy, high-level, if you're making art book type of printers. But the quality was very good. Mm-hmm. And, added bonus, you know that they have environmental protections in place for how their business operates that are not in place if you're working with a printer in Asia, generally, at least, you know, China or Indonesia. I followed his advice, and when I contacted Odi, they were very easy to work with at that time.
Mm-hmm.
This was a long time ago. Maybe they are now too, I don't know. And they allowed me even to go on press during the printing, and went to Iceland for the first time and was press and making small adjustments to the printing.
Mm.
They were flexible with that. And so it was a good... process. Brilliant. Of course, after that came the marketing, which, as everyone knows, is the biggest headache with self-publishing. But it was, immense learning curve. But, here I am now. I'm still doing it.
Yeah, I know. And then the second book? What was the second book?
So the second book was on my Japanese pilgrimage. East to West. It was a soft cover, although I also did print it with Odi in Iceland. Right. And since then, I haven't done, except for Mimi's book, right? Yeah. I haven't done a bigger offset press book like that.
Okay.
So since those first two, most of my books have been very small runs, either handmade in some cases, like I learned hand book binding.
You make the process yourself.
Yeah. So for example, my book, Traces of Time, which is one of my more recent full-scale books published in 2022, there's only, I think, 6 copies existing.
Okay.
Because I made each one. You know, I printed every single page myself, cut it myself, bound it myself, sewed the book together myself. So when you're doing that, some people have the patience to do that and make 10 or 20 books, but I was like five. Five's enough. And of course, correspondingly, there are objects, right? Mm-hmm. And quite expensive. But, you know, every single book, you have to judge what the best audience for it is. A book like 333 Saints, my book on Timbuktu, I felt it's a book that should get out to more people in terms of especially academic interest in it. There is the interest for that. So I went with the, you know, 500 copies offset press. A book like Traces of Time, if I was a more famous photographer, it might make sense to make it offset press edition of 500. But considering my current level of fame or my current audience space, it just doesn't, it's a great little landscape book, but it just doesn't make sense for me in terms of how many people are gonna buy it, to go that route.
Talking about Next Books and Mimi, who is a Belgian-based artist and poet, Mimi Koens, who you've published her last book, Mother Tongue. Is that the power of the interwebs, or how did that happen? How did you guys end up? I mean, of course, I asked her as well, but which I have, but I hadn't had a chance to really go into how did that, you know, creative, amazing book come together. But how did that happen? And
so maybe and I met on an artist residency in Scotland.
Ah, right. Okay.
Yeah, well, I did my master's of fine art a bit late. I actually had a master's in journalism in 2004. As I said, my early work was documentary, so that made sense. But once things changed and I realized I really was going in a fine art direction, I realized I needed a master's in fine art. So I went to the Glasgow School of Art, and during that year, I also did this week-long residency in the Cairngorms that Mimi also happened to be on.
Oh, what a coincidence.
And we met then, and she, partly inspired by that residency, as you know, she went on to make this festival, art festival, art and poetry festival in Brussels called Something Beautiful.
Yeah, it's cool. It is super beautiful.
Yeah.
Yeah,
and which I was a part of, because the first one, a lot of the people she invited to participate were people she'd met on residencies. So in the course of that first residency, I stayed with Mimi for a bit. And of course, there was a lot of collaboration and working together in the process of the festival, because it's very much a community-based endeavor, absolutely, you know, everyone pitching in. And I think one thing that both Mimi and I, in the course of our lives, have realized, she probably realized it younger than I did, but is that who you work with, it makes all the difference in both your life and your career. And it's essential to think critically, in fact, about the people around you and if they are good partners to be working with. If you have a choice. Of course, sometimes you have a job where you don't have a choice with that. But in the creative fields, often you do have a choice to choose your collaborators. And so in the course of that festival, I observed, of course, the people around me, as I always do nowadays. And I saw that Mimi was someone who followed through on what she said, right? If she says she's going to make a festival and she organizes it for people, it happens.
Yeah.
You know, if she says in conversation, even if it's casually, I'm going to send you this or that, she actually does it. And I'm the kind of person who, that kind of thing is really important to me, especially if I'm going to work with someone.
Yeah.
So I noticed that, and we got along well anyway, you know, as two human beings, two women. And so we continued our sort of online conversations, emails after the festival. She suggested to me, told me about the residency at the Villa Empain in Brussels, which I decided to apply for. Unfortunately, I got it. So then in 2021, I returned to Brussels on that residency and, you know, got to know Mimi more, especially because we'd ended up chatting a lot over the pandemic, you know, and since the pandemic being the pandemic, it didn't matter that she was in Brussels and I was in New Mexico, right? The people a lot of times you have your small bubble, of course, right around you. But I think a lot of people during the pandemic, you also had your online support friends.
Yeah.
And they could be anywhere. And I think Bibi and I, we were each other's online support friends, you know, chatting.
Yeah.
During the pandemic, and we came up with this idea that when I was in Brussels, and which kept being put off, right? The residency was supposed to happen in 2020, kept moving.
Yeah.
So we knew I was coming to Brussels, but we weren't quite sure when. That we would also do this little maybe a collaboration while I was there on the park that was near the villa, and that eventually turned in, you know, that. That's what made me focus on the park, the Jardin de la Brie des Combes, and make my project traces.
Okay, amazing.
Yeah, so
yeah.
So during that residency, actually, so I ended up making two books.
Mm.
One was this book, Traces of Time, as I said, which is like handmade edition of five books, which is just my photographs. And the other book that came out of it was this collaboration I did with Mimi, with her paintings and my photographs. Called A Walk in the Park.
Okay, yeah.
So, you know, our relationship as artists and as collaborators has built, you know, over the years. Certainly when you make a collaborative book together, you learn.
Absolutely.
You know, very, very, very deeply how the other person works. Mm. And so that was also in 2021 when she showed me the manuscript from Mother Tongue.
Okay.
And which was in manuscript form. There, I read it and I said, "This is great, and you should find a real pub." I mean, I was already a self publisher, but you should find a big publisher. Like, it's hard to know if you will find one because, as I know myself, you could have an incredibly worthy project, and because you're not well known or you don't have backing and it's your first book, nobody is going to support it. But you should try. You know, this is a good enough book that it should definitely try.
Yeah.
And I don't know the details of who she did or didn't contact in that process. I know she did contact some, you know, some big publishers. But in the end, she asked me if I wanted to publish it.
Brilliant.
So I knew it was, I knew I liked the book.
Yeah.
I knew it was a worthy book. It should be published and published really nicely.
Mm-hmm.
I knew she was someone I could work with well. I'm also someone who gives, you know, it's all about due diligence. So at the beginning of our conversation about that, we each drew up a list of what we'd expect in the publication process and made a contract.
Oh, that's good. Yeah.
You know, to iron out all the details just to make sure the communication was clear. Because the type of publishing, you know, I'm doing with Mimi it's very different from a big publisher.
Yeah.
In a way, I could offer her a lot more advice and specific direction when it came to the design of the book and the actual, you know, graphic editing and layout. But the help I can offer in terms of distribution and marketing is really limited. So, you know, there's very important conversations we had to have about who's responsible for what, who has the final decision on things. So, you know, it's based on friendship, but we're both of us practical enough people to know that you have to make sure that all of these, you know, specific legal, financial things are made clear ahead of time in order for the collaboration to work. And so that you're still friends at the end, right? Which I'm glad to say we are.
How have you found it since it's been like it's a finished book? What do you think?
Yeah, well, I'm really happy with how it came out, how it looks.
Yeah.
I mean, we also properly drafted everything. I have a high level printer, so I did checks on the printing.
Hmm.
you know, to make sure that it would, the images, we wouldn't have any bad surprises, right? When it, you want to check all of that stuff beforehand, you know, before you have 500 books made by the printer. So we did what we need to do. And, you know, as someone who's published both offset books and handmade books, I have, you know, I have the experience to know what we need to check and what we need to look at, especially for an image-based book. So, you know, on my part, there weren't any nasty surprises in the in the final book, which, you know, I would give Mimi a lot of advice in the process, you know, like I'm like the midwife for the book. And I'm like, you know, Mimi, our goal is so that probably there'll be one or two little things when the book is printed that you don't like.
Right.
But our goal is to make sure it's just one or two little things.
Yeah, yeah.
And that you forget about it after a month or two. No. And I think we could say that happened. And as you know, having seen the book, and I've heard even in again, Mimi's done a very good job of getting people to write reviews of it or doing online interviews about it. I've heard people say it's a very unusual format. Mm-hmm. And I think for a poetry book, it is unusual. That was a decision we made early on. I basically laid out for her. I was like, we have two choices. You have to make the decision now, because Mimi had the final say on these decisions. Either we go with the classic poetry book format, you know, of it being fairly small, half A4, maybe a little bit bigger, portrait format, where the images are there, but more as to the side of the poems. Less in interaction to the poems. It could be soft cover even. A much, much cheaper book to make. Or we change the layout. You go for hardcover and you really work on this interaction on the page between the image and the poem and how everything's laid out. And that called for a redesign, which took a lot of time we didn't expect over the summer. But in the end, I'm happy. I think Mimi's happy that we made that decision. And it means it is an unusual format for a poetry book. Yeah. But the interesting thing is what I've realized, especially showing it to people. I had a copy. I was in New York in December. I showed it to a lot of my friends, and it's actually perfect as a gift book.
Absolutely.
Right. And if it was just the size and price and format of a poetry book, it would, in a way, potentially have less of an audience than it does in its current format. Mm. In its current format, as a large, beautiful hardcover book, reasonably priced, but, you know, fair for its size and what it is, it operates also as a really great gift, you know. Giving someone a book that beautiful and hardcover and put together as a gift makes a lot more sense, you know, when they're pregnant, for example, just had another child, then giving them a small poetry book of 15 euro or something, you know, soft cover. So it actually, I didn't necessarily anticipate that in the decision. It was more about what makes the most sense to respect in Mimi's work, the painting and the poetry and how they can interact on the page in the most dynamic way possible. But in retrospect, you know, as a publisher, it actually, I think, was a good decision, because motherhood is a time where you give gifts to people. And so it does work well. I guess in Belgium, it's not as common, but here in the US, you have baby showers. Right?
Yeah.
In US, UK, there's this whole baby shower tradition.
In Australia as well. No, it's absolutely perfect for that. You're right. No, it'll be interesting to see how it travels. But just to go back to the publishing experience and to the life of that. So you've seen a massive shift, obviously, in the last 10 years since the first book. What do you think? What have you seen since, like from the first one to now with this book and two other maybe projects that you're looking at?
Yeah, it's, I mean, for sure, the publishing industry has a lot of troubles. I'm not sure how much of those trouble is because of changes in our society and how much of that trouble is because the industry makes decisions which creates right. trouble for itself. I mean, yes, you could say less people read, but at the same time, anything seems to be, if you really put effort in, anything can be marketed.
Sure.
Especially if you're a big company.
Sure.
You know, if people can make and sell half of the things they do that are sold in know, gift stores or, you know, Kmart or whatever, like, there's so, like, if effort is put in, you can sell just about anything, honestly.
I'm with you on that.
Right? Especially if you put the intelligence in ahead of time to make it a work with an audience. And I feel, you know, when I see a lot of the decisions that big publishers are making, I don't know. I feel like they're following this kind of bottom line mentality that a lot of businesses are making in our time. This kind of thinking where they make very safe decisions that protect their bottom line. They don't take risks and they fundamentally don't support the creator. And especially in big markets, and the English speaking market is a big market. In fact, this is circumstantial, but I feel like when it comes to publishing, some of the problems are worse when it comes to the English-speaking world than to other places, say Icelandic publishing world or the French publishing or the Dutch publishing world. These are much smaller markets, and I think they often operate differently than the English-speaking market. And a lot of the problems we're talking about in terms of the publishing industry is much worse with the English-speaking publishing market because it is so big. And so it's hard for, yes, of course, you have this problem of people's attention spans and blah, blah, blah. But a well-made book can accommodate that. I mean, even like the book that Mimi and I just made, like you only need an attention span of like 30 seconds to read one of her poems.
Exactly.
Yeah. Right. Oh, but even if you go back, I'm in the process of reading Letters to a Young Stoic by Seneca, classic of classics.
Yeah, yeah.
His letters were pretty short.
Yeah.
You know, you don't actually need a long attention span to read Seneca. Mm-hmm. And in fact, he's even like now he has this resurgence and tons of people are buying his books and reading it. So this is why I feel like so many people talk about how people changing, people reading less, the problem of our time. Mm-hmm. But I get it. But if you're a creative publisher, you know, who's willing to do the work that's involved in marketing, which you should be if you're a big publisher, who's willing to work with dynamic and intelligent authors to make works that are really intelligent, but also appealing to the type of public that exists now. It shouldn't be a problem.
Yeah.
But I feel like it's just a lot of kind of lazy thinking, a lot of making decisions that's just about the bottom line, a lack of kind of respect for supporting authors because they can get away with that now. I don't know.
Thanks so much, Alexander. I really, really appreciate it. I wish you all the best with the book and the books and the art. Thanks so much. And we can't wait to see your new works then when they come. But
thank you for asking me to be on this podcast.
No, no problem. Take care. And hopefully we'll get to talk to you again.
Absolutely. Maybe in Belgium.
Hopefully.
So that was Alexandra Huddleston. Thank you so much for listening. We will be back shortly with more great conversation, we hope, on writing, books, ideas, short stories, long stories, novels, fiction, non-fiction. If there is anyone that you'd love to hear coming out of this podcast channel, please get in touch and let us know any thoughts or ideas at info@writefest.be. We're also on Instagram and Blue Sky. We thank very much our producer, Paul McNally, who puts this podcast together, and this, the dulcet tones of Craig Winnicker's guitar is what you hear in the outro and the intro. So thanks to everyone, and more info on writefest.be.